Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. First on this week's program, Pinell County Attorney's top investigator body slammed black teen. This story was written by Stephen Lemons and was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on April 6th. This story is part of the Arizona Watchdog Project, a year-long reporting effort led by New Times and supported by the Trace Foundation, in partnership with Deep South Today. The controversial chief of investigations for embattled Pinell County attorney Brad Miller has been hard at work, doing traffic enforcement in Casa Grande and roughing up a black teenager. According to court documents, Richard Hank Mueller, who is paid nearly $100,000 a year to oversee a small pool of investigators for the county attorney's office, stopped Ravion Johnson for allegedly running through a stop sign on his bike on his way home from school on March 26th. Instead of ticketing the teenager, Mueller searched him and body slammed him, allegedly causing injuries to the 18-year-old's arms, legs, and head. Mueller then arrested Johnson, who spent the night in county jail. Soon after, all criminal charges were dropped. Miller hired Mueller in January 2025 to be his chief of investigations, despite a track record of concerning behavior. As Phoenix New Times has previously reported, that includes a drunken bar fight in 2012 that landed him on the Pinell County Attorney's Office Brady list of shady cops and got him canned from his gig as a deputy for the Pinell County Sheriff's Office. Lowlights from Mueller's subsequent stints at small Arizona cop shops involved shooting a fleeing suspect and busting into an elderly, disabled man's home on a false warrant with other police, who tased and beat the man and then arrested him on bogus charges. Mueller's new gig, theoretically, should have kept him out of any scenarios in which he could knock somebody around. Normally, the county attorney's investigators assist prosecutors in preparing cases for trial, not patrolling the mean streets of Casa Grande, looking for traffic scofflaws. Yet, for some reason, that's where Mueller found himself late last month. In an interview with New Times at his Casa Grande home, Johnson explained that he was riding his electric bike home after taking a test that morning at PPEPTEC High School, when Mueller flashed his lights at him from an unmarked vehicle parked nearby. Johnson stopped, and Mueller ordered him to the curb with his hands on his head. Johnson said Mueller was wearing a tactical vest with the word police on it, but did not otherwise identify himself. Johnson had taken out his ear pods so he could hear Mueller, but they fell out of his hand, and he tried to put them in his pocket. That's when the situation escalated. "I opened my hand, trying to show him it's just my headphones," Johnson recalled. "He's telling me to drop it, and before I could even drop it, I was already on the ground. I felt like I was on the ground forever. It was hot." According to a probable cause statement submitted to the court, Johnson was, quote, "assisted to the prone position," unquote, by Mueller, who is nicknamed Hank the Tank and resembles a refrigerator with a head on it. Johnson, who is 5'4" and weighs less than 150 pounds, supposedly injured the tank while the slight, skinny teen was lying beneath the bruiser. The probable cause statement claims Mueller sustained multiple abrasions to the hands and wrists after he tackled Johnson. Johnson said Mueller kneed him in the back, putting all his weight onto him. The teenager screamed for help, and people emerged from nearby businesses to watch. The young man asked to speak to Mueller's supervisor, but Mueller laughed him off. He was like, "I'm the chief, so good luck with that," or something like that, Johnson recalled. On the arrest paperwork, Mueller is identified as Chief H. Mueller. injuries, and a night in jail. Mueller's rough treatment apparently caused injuries to the teen. Johnson and his mom, Alicia Henry, shared several photos of abrasions on Johnson's arms and head, taken after he was released from custody. "You can't really see it on my leg," Johnson said, "but my leg was all bruised up. I still feel it. My face was all scraped up and stuff." Instead of citing and releasing Johnson for a traffic offense, or just letting him off with a warning, Mueller cuffed Johnson, charging him with lying to a law enforcement officer, obstructing government operations, and resisting arrest. The first two are Class 1 misdemeanors, and the third is a Class 6 felony. According to a probable cause statement on file with the court, Johnson's lying allegedly involved Johnson telling Mueller that he was 17, despite turning 18 on January 1st. The obstruction charge is unexplained, but the charge of resisting arrest arose because, during a pat-down, Johnson allegedly began to tense his arms and attempt to pull his hands away, which were controlled by the officer behind his head. Johnson, who has no prior arrest record, according to the charging documents, was transported by Casa Grande police to its offices and later booked into the Pinal County Jail in Florence, where he spent the night in a holding tank. A spokesperson for the Casa Grande Police Department told New Times that the agency was not involved in the arrest, but responded to the scene because Mueller didn't have the means to transport the person, likely because Mueller's vehicle had no secured cage for arrestees, as is standard in police vehicles. Johnson's phone had been confiscated, and he didn't have his mom's cell phone memorized, so he couldn't call her. Henry said that Mueller and some other law enforcement officers returned her son's bike and backpack to her early that afternoon, while Johnson believes he was still at a nearby Casa Grande police station. Johnson thinks the cops were milking the situation so that he had to spend a night in a dirty holding cell with about 11 other prisoners and no bed, calling it a traumatic experience. A judge eventually released Johnson on his own recognizance. A March 31st message in the court file from the county attorney's office stated that charges have been declined, though Johnson told New Times that he believes he still has a court date on April 10th. Johnson said he is still frightened after the ordeal. His mom is worried because she thinks that she's seen Mueller ride by their home a couple of times after her son was set free. Both believe Johnson was profiled by Mueller, who is white. "I think it was racial discrimination, because when he stopped me, I felt like he was just trying to look for a gun or something, trying to see if I had some drugs or something," Johnson said. He added that when he asked why Mueller couldn't just give him a warning, Mueller replied, "You think I want to be doing this? I'm looking for people with warrants and stuff like that. I'm not looking for people passing stop signs." Vanilla Ice. Asked about Mueller's arrest of Johnson, Miller's office emailed New Times a blustery statement. "Over the past decade, PCAO has participated in successful multi-jurisdictional, multi-task force operations," it read. "Yet when our officers were doing the heavy lifting to keep our community safe, Stephen Lemons and the Phoenix New Times were nowhere to be found. They did not cover the many successes over the past year or the bravery of the men and women from PCAO, including this investigator. Now, however, Lemons has suddenly surfaced to run coordinated hit pieces against our enforcement. It is the height of hypocrisy to ignore large, successful operations that remove predators from our neighborhoods, only to turn around and cherry-pick one isolated moment to push an anti-law enforcement narrative." And yet, that last sentence seems to acknowledge that Mueller's arrest of Johnson was a screw-up. Certainly, there is nothing courageous about Mueller's apparent manhandling of a much smaller individual who is quite obviously no threat to anyone. That's bullying, not bravery. Kent Volkmer, who served as Pinal County attorney before Miller defeated him in the 2024 GOP primary, called Miller's use of his agency's investigators to perform ordinary police functions a waste of limited resources. Volkmer added that the investigators he hired would make an arrest only if they had no choice but to take that person into custody at this time for the safety of everyone around them. The office's investigators are there to help us with the currently existing cases, not to develop and build new cases. If there's a law enforcement issue in the community, he said, the best way to deal with it is by going to the county's sheriff and police chiefs. But obviously, Mr. Miller has a different take than me, Volkmer said, pointing to Miller's decision to strike a wildcat cooperation deal with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which the County Board of Supervisors says was illegal. Mueller also serves as the county attorney's law enforcement liaison with ICE pursuant to that agreement. Additionally, police reports obtained from the Apache Junction Police Department show that in 2025, Miller's office led a task force of several local agencies, which set up sex trafficking stings by engaging men online who were allegedly looking to purchase sex from underage girls. According to various sources, most of the heavy lifting was done by the local cop shops, though Miller's office supposedly issued a challenge coin to commemorate the event. The county attorney's office has not answered New Times questions about whether the Brady-listed Mueller was involved in these activities, or if Miller's investigators crossing into regular police work creates conflict of interest for the county attorney's office, which is responsible for prosecuting such cases. Regardless, Miller seems unconcerned by appearances. Earlier this year, allegations of sex discrimination by his office and accusations that he and his staff have used encrypted apps to get around state public records law triggered a complaint by the Pinal County Board of Supervisors to the Arizona Attorney General's office. The Pinal County Supervisors and Pinal County Sheriff Ross Teeple are suing Miller over his agreement with ICE, which has been preliminarily enjoined. The suit has been since moved to Maricopa County Superior Court. The supervisors and the sheriff, who are Republicans like Miller, argue that Miller acted without the supervisor's consent and that the ICE contract increases the county's potential liability, in part due to possible future allegations of racial discrimination. Though, as Mueller has since demonstrated, you don't need a fancy ICE agreement to stumble into one of those. Next, a story written by Zach Buchanan and posted on April 10th. You don't say. Measles, RFK Jr. reappear in the valley at the same time. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the prominent anti-vaxxer who happens to also have a death grip on the American health system, as the current Secretary of Health and Human Services, returned to the Valley this past week for a series of official appearances. A trip to the Phoenix area was also made by one of RFK Jr.'s closest acquaintances, measles. On Thursday, the Maricopa County Department of Public Health announced that a new measles case had been identified in the county, which is not linked to the county's previous four measles cases and has no known source of exposure. The county listed three exposure sites, all in Queen Creek. The Costco on South Ellsworth Road from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. on April 3rd. The Walmart on East Rittenhouse Road from 8:15 a.m. to 10:45 a.m. on April 4th. And Generation Church, Queen Creek at Faith Mather Sossaman Elementary from 8:45 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. on April 5th. Kennedy, under whose watch measles cases have exploded in Arizona and elsewhere, was in the valley from April 4th through April 8th. Coincidence? Well, yes. Kennedy may have done more than his fair share to weaken the public health system's measles preparedness, but it's not like he's personally reintroducing the incredibly infectious virus around the country. Though, just to be sure, Phoenix New Times cross-checked the locations of his public appearances, including a campaign event with GOP congressional candidate Jay Feely, and an appearance at the Gila River Indian community with the exposure sites. There was no overlap. Still, it's no coincidence that measles has thrived on Kennedy's watch. Prior to joining the Trump administration last year, Kennedy was the preeminent anti-vaxxer voice in the world, helping to spread unfounded vaccine skepticism by propagating debunked conspiracy theories. In his time at HHS, the department and its sub-agencies, like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has systematically worked to dismantle vaccine protections. In January, the CDC's Vaccine Advisory Committee changed the recommended childhood vaccine schedule to no longer recommend several vaccines in early childhood, despite proven and long-standing safety records for each. A federal judge blocked that change, but on Thursday, the CDC attempted to maneuver around that by announcing a new charter for the committee. The measles vaccine was not among those the CDC stopped recommending, but Kennedy's track record on measles is less than stellar. When a huge measles outbreak popped up in West Texas in early 2025, Kennedy pushed unconventional treatments like taking vitamin A, rather than advocating for vaccine uptake. He's also spread misinformation about the measles vaccine, falsely claiming it causes deaths every year. Measles outbreaks have exploded across the country on his watch. Between 2025 and 2026, there have been 290 cases in Arizona, 597 in Utah, 979 in Texas, and 1,000 in South Carolina, up from a combined 7 in those states in 2024, leading Kennedy to finally push for vaccination publicly. In Arizona, measles has spread in the former fundamentalist Mormon community of Short Creek on the Arizona-Utah border. But more urban areas have been largely spared. Maricopa County has had 4 cases before this week, though they haven't led to sustained outbreaks. But there are reasons to be on high alert. For one, vaccination rates in the East Valley are generally below what's required for herd immunity. Secondly, one of the exposure sites was an Easter egg hunt attended by children, who are more likely to suffer severe health effects if they're unvaccinated. Any potential exposure to measles at a community event is concerning, especially one involving children, said Community Health Department spokesperson Courtney Cruz-Weissner in an emailed statement to New Times. At this time, Maricopa County Department of Public Health is not seeing evidence that this case poses a greater risk than others. Measles is highly contagious in any setting where people are unvaccinated, which is why we are focused on identifying and notifying those who may have been exposed so they can monitor for symptoms and prevent further spread. In its initial advisory about the new measles exposure, the County Health Department hit a lot of the notes that Kennedy has often been reluctant to play. It explained that measles spreads easily, infecting roughly 90% of unvaccinated people exposed to it. It shared that there is no treatment for measles and that it can have long-term health impacts, including subacute sclerosing panencephalitis, a brain infection which may not appear until years after a person's initial measles infection. It cautioned to watch for symptoms for 21 days. Perhaps most importantly, it advised that measles is largely preventable with 2 doses of the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. We've prevented measles outbreaks for years by staying up to date on vaccinations, said Health Department Assistant Medical Director Dr. Maria Merrick. If you've been meaning to get the measles vaccine, this is your reminder. Measles spreads easily, and vaccination is the best way to protect yourself and others. ICE suddenly decrowded packed Mesa facility before a congressional visit. This next story was written by Jared McDonald Evoy of the Arizona Mirror and was posted on the New Times website on April 9th. When Democratic Representatives Greg Stanton and Yasemin Ansari visited an Immigration and Customs Enforcement holding facility in Mesa earlier this year, meant to temporarily house 157 people, it was one of the few times the facility had been under capacity in more than a month. Just 2 weeks prior, there were 513 people housed there in a single day. And a couple of weeks before that, there were nearly 800 people being housed in the facility tucked into an unassuming corner of a suburban Phoenix airport. From January 15th to February 20th, when the two members of Congress visited the Arizona Removal Operations Coordination Center, the facility had spent 33 of 37 days over capacity, some days with several times the number of people the facility is authorized to house. In the 7 days after Ansari and Stanton told ICE they would be visiting the facility, members of Congress are allowed to inspect facilities, but ICE policy requires they give 7 days' notice before arriving, the number of detainees began to decrease to some of the lowest numbers the facility has seen all year. Almost immediately after the inspection, those numbers began to climb again. The facility, first exclusively reported on by the Arizona Mirror, is a 25,000-square-foot facility at the Mesa Gateway Airport. It opened in 2010 to little fanfare and can house up to 157 detainees and 79 ICE employees, according to an ICE press release announcing its completion. It is one of many temporary hold facilities across the country, meant to house detainees for short periods of time before they are shipped to longer-term facilities or removed from the country. But a mirror analysis of data of ICE detention records that the Deportation Data Project obtained via the Freedom of Information Act showed that, in some cases, detainees have stayed for longer than the 12 hours ICE has said the facility is meant for. Newly released data now shows that the facility, which in previous years has stayed below the 157 capacity of the facility, has been surging well above that number, and detainees are staying for longer. The Deportation Data Project relies on information releases that have not been reviewed, audited, or given context, I said in a statement to the Mirror. Neither the Department of Homeland Security nor ICE have verified the accuracy, methodology, or analysis of the project and its results. The bottom line is that the Deportation Data Project is not accurate. However, the data obtained by the Deportation Data Project comes directly from the agency. ICE sent us these data sets in response to a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit. We posted the original data, the Deportation Data Project said in a statement to the Mirror. These are ICE's own records of who was arrested, detained, and deported. The Mesa ICE connection. Arizona, and specifically Mesa Gateway Airport, is at the center of ICE's accelerating aerial deportation efforts, in which AROCC plays a major role. The airport hosts the agency's headquarters for its ICE Air operations, which uses subcontractors and subleases to disguise deportation aircraft. The AROCC facility has also been at the heart of flights that have sent immigrants to African countries, even when they're not from those countries. Most recently, the facility made national headlines because it was set to be where two gay Iranian men were set to be deported from, ultimately to their deaths. In data provided to the Mirror by ICE Flight Monitor, a data-driven initiative published by Human Rights First, flights out of AROCC this year appear to largely be domestic shuttle flights. Such flights are when ICE transports individuals, generally on chartered aircraft, to and between immigration detention centers across the United States. Temporary hold facilities in New York, Los Angeles, and Baltimore have come under scrutiny for lacking beds and food, leading to lawsuits against ICE. Similarly, AROCC does not have showers, beds, or on-site medical care, according to past audits of the facility. Medical care or other needs would fall under the purview of ICE's Florence Services Processing Center, an hour drive away. I said that it only uses the facility for the short-term detention of individuals and holds them for typically under 12 hours and complies with all applicable standards. The agency said AROCC serves as a transit and staging hub, similar to a layover at a commercial airport. Flight delays, cancellations, or mechanical issues may occur, and ICE personnel adjust operations to maintain continuity of care and security, ICE said. Facility population levels fluctuate based on flight schedules and operational needs. During peak arrivals and departures, on-site numbers may temporarily increase, then decrease as flights depart and processing concludes. This is a normal part of operations. The agency also said it has increased removal flights to address case backlogs, resulting in higher volumes at AROCC. Population counts may temporarily reflect individuals arriving or departing by ground or air, which can inflate numbers during high-volume movements. In its statements to the Mirror, ICE said it also works with local authorities who are promptly notified of emergencies or significant developments. The Mesa Fire and Medical Department said it was looking into a request by the Mirror asking if ICE had notified their agency or the city when the facility had been over capacity, but did not respond before publication. We have seen serious problems with overcrowding at ICE field offices around the country, Aaron Reichland Melnick, senior fellow at the American Immigration Council, told the Mirror. It really heralded what we would see in the months to follow. Lawsuits have followed, leading to ICE shutting down some facilities temporarily, like in Baltimore, where the detainees were sent to Arizona before an oversight visit by members of Congress. Courts are also getting flooded with requests from detainees seeking relief. In Arizona, at AROCC, those who are staying at the facility are staying for longer periods of time in larger populations. The average length of stay in 2026 is about 36 hours, compared to the same time frame in 2025, when the average stay was about 12 hours. In 2025, the average daily population was approximately 21 people for the same time frame. So far in 2026, there have been an average of 274 detainees each day. The Mirror found one individual in the data who stayed for 18 days, coinciding with a time when the population of the facility was near its peak of 777 individuals in a single day. For Ansari, the issue is crystal clear. ICE is arresting more people than it has the capacity for, in order to meet President Donald Trump's mass deportation agenda. When you keep growing into it, it becomes very clear that you have people staying longer than they should be, or places are over capacity. That is just simple math that anyone can figure out, Ansari told the Mirror. The irony is they would never admit to that. The number gap and the fact that they are going to have to break their own standards, but when you ask them how often that happens, they brush it under the rug and act like it never happens. Ansari said that when she visited the facility in February, ICE officials told her that they had more people detained nationwide than the number of available beds. Reichland Melnick agrees with Ansari's assessment. I think this is a side effect of mass deportations, he said, adding that the agency is running into very real logistical bottlenecks as they are trying to fulfill arrest and deportation quotas set by the administration. Reichlin Melnick also wasn't surprised to hear that ICE may have shuffled detainees around prior to the oversight visit by Ansari and Stanton. This allegation has come up elsewhere in the country, he said. When a group of Maryland lawmakers attempted to visit an ICE facility unannounced earlier this year, they found the facility empty. That facility in Baltimore had previously been the site of an alleged Legionella outbreak and the subject of a lawsuit for inhumane conditions. When Minnesota lawmakers went on an oversight visit to a similar facility in their state, it was also empty. The same thing happened to lawmakers in California. I can't say that it was obvious to me that there were mass movements of people, but I'm not surprised at all that they make things look much nicer when they know members of Congress are coming, Ansari said, noting that ICE makes lawmakers fill out forms and give prior notice before visits. Historical context. Arizona also has some historical context around this particular issue. In Doe v. Wolf, several groups, including the American Immigration Council, filed a class action lawsuit challenging the conditions at detention centers run by U.S. Customs and Border Protection. The suit focused primarily on two women and two men detained in the Tucson Border Patrol Station who described overcrowding, lack of beds, inadequate food and water, lack of medical care, and freezing conditions. The court eventually enjoined CPB from holding detainees longer than 48 hours unless they could provide adequate conditions that included a bed with a blanket, shower, food, and more, deeming anything less than that unconstitutional. Reichlin Melnick said that while the context might be different, families detained at the border versus people arrested in the interior of the United States, stories about the conditions are similar. He also noted that during the lawsuit, cleaning crews would show up at the facility 24 hours prior to court-sanctioned inspections. I think it is possible it is a coincidence. It is possible there is more going on, Reichlin Melnick said. However, he added that there is a solution to this issue. The answer is surprise inspections, and this is something that the Trump administration fought bitterly to prevent. In a statement to the Mirror, ICE admitted that visits are scheduled during times when there are less detainees at the facilities. Congressional and VIP visits are scheduled during lower operational periods to minimize impact on mission-critical activities, ICE said. ICE does not alter procedures or inconvenience individuals in custody for these visits, and all core operations continue as usual, with safety and security as top priorities. For Ansari, though, the truth comes not from oversight visits, but from speaking directly to the people they detain. I think no matter what, the real picture and the real situation cannot be understood unless you talk to people who are detained there, Ansari said. Even that day, even if there were far fewer people there, I feel if I talked to people, they would probably have told me there were far more people here. Ansari said she wasn't allowed to speak to anyone at AROCC that day. And talking to those who have been released from detention is what Ansari, Stanton, and other members of Arizona's congressional delegation are doing. At a community briefing last week, Ansari and U.S. Representative Adelita Grijalva, a Tucson Democrat, heard about the conditions inside these facilities from family members of detainees, detainees themselves, and those who advocate for them. During the meeting, Ansari also advocated for abolishing ICE, a call that many in her own party have rejected, despite the rising popularity of the movement. But Ansari said she is undeterred and believes reforms could happen if Democrats make major gains during this year's midterm elections. I think that even the most historically moderate members of the Democratic Party have seen how horrific this agency has become, Ansari said. I think the need for vast overhaul and oversight is going to be a top priority for Democrats. This story was first published by the Arizona Mirror, which is part of State's Newsroom, a network of news bureaus supported by grants and a coalition of donors as a 501c3 public charity. Writer Morgan Fisher brings us this next story that was posted on April 9th. ICE holds Arizona detainees for months. This legal tactic is freeing them. For 8.5 months, Kelly Yu sat in an immigration detention center in Eloy. An undocumented immigrant from China, she was far from her husband and daughter, both U.S. citizens, and far from the chain of West Valley sushi restaurants they ran together. Yu's detention became national news. Representative Greg Stanton and Senator Mark Kelly visited her in Immigration and Customs Enforcement lockup, and Senator Ruben Gallego met with her family at one of their restaurants. Local political activists from both sides of the aisle even teamed up to ask the White House for her release. Yes, they noted, Yu had entered the country illegally 2 decades ago and had a removal order, but she'd also built a family and a business and had become a staple of the community. She should be spared deportation. Despite that advocacy, it seemed the only way she was getting out would be on a plane back to China. But earlier this year, something changed. In late February, Yu was released, not through the advocacy of local representatives or public outcry, but thanks to a simple court filing. An attorney for Yu filed a habeas corpus petition challenging the legality of her detention, and it worked. In Arizona and across the country, habeas petitions are the court filing du jour in immigration law. Habeas corpus petitions require the government to justify detaining or imprisoning a person, calling upon the Fifth Amendment's requirement that no one be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Despite that, habeas petitions are not all that common in modern-day courts. Last March, only 2 habeas petitions were filed in the United States District Court for the District of Arizona. But a lot can change in a year. Last month, nearly 350 habeas petitions were filed in Arizona District Court, according to a tracking service. That's more than were filed in the District of Arizona all of last year. The uptick began in September. Nearly 82% of 2025 habeas filings occurred in the last 4 months of the year and has continued into 2026. This year, more than 900 of these same petitions were filed in the first 3 months alone. Yu's attorney, Bianca Villalpando, filed her first habeas petition in December. She's since filed between 15 and 20 on behalf of detained clients. So far, only one of them has been detained. "This is never something we've had to do," Villalpando said. "This was a big learning curve for a lot of attorneys because it really came down to, like, this was the last resort. No other options. Why have habeas petitions gone through the roof? Because the federal government has left detainees few other recourses. As the Trump administration has pursued a mass deportation agenda, immigration authorities have been detaining anyone and everyone they can. ICE also has resisted paroling people entering the country without authorization. That is, releasing them as their immigration cases progress. This has drastically increased the country's detention population, and the administration is buying up warehouses nationwide to expand its detention capacity. There's definitely a policy move toward increasing the number of people in detention," said Brian Green, a Denver-based immigration attorney who has filed habeas petitions in Arizona. "Increasing the detention space around the country and to make people in the U.S. who are detained uncomfortable and to disincentivize people coming to the United States." In July, as part of this effort, ICE reinterpreted a federal law to deny bail to anyone who entered the country without legal authorization, which Green called an extreme position both legally and historically. Previously, immigrants entering the country would be briefly detained before generally being granted bail and paroled into the country with the condition that they make required court dates and check-ins with immigration authorities. But in September, the Board of Immigration Appeals affirmed the new no-bail policy, which effectively eliminated bond hearings for millions of people, including longtime residents with deep community ties. That includes you. At 18 years old, she fled from China while pregnant and sought asylum in the U.S. Her asylum claim was denied in 2004, and she was given a removal order in 2005, and her final appeal was dismissed in 2016. But as her case worked through the immigration system, you opened two restaurants and planned to open a third. Then, in October of 2024, while Joe Biden was still president, ICE arrested and detained you, despite her having no criminal record. She was sent to Eloy, then sent to a detention center in Texas, and then released with an ankle monitor after 90 days. In May of 2025, with Trump back in office, ICE re-detained her at an immigration check-in and sent her back to Eloy, where she languished for months. "They're trying to keep people detained so they can give up," Villalpando said. "Who wants to be in jail, especially if you haven't necessarily committed a crime?" Countless detainees have been in the same position, especially since the procedural change in September. So, as a last resort, immigration attorneys began filing habeas petitions to compel ICE to either grant their clients a bond hearing or release them from detention. Detainees have also been filing these petitions en masse on their own, often with the help of the Florence Immigration and Refugee Rights Project, which provides free legal services to Arizona immigrants in detention. The group provides detainees with habeas petition templates, pays the $5 filing fee, and delivers the filing to the court. And, like in Yu's case, they started winning. More filings, more wins. Generally, habeas petitions are filed for detainees in two situations: those who have removal orders and those who have what's called a withholding of removal orders. If a detainee has a removal order, the government has 180 days after detaining them to remove them from the country before it's considered unreasonable to keep them in detention, Green said. If the detention spans past that time, a habeas petition may result in a federal judge ordering a detainee's release if the government can't show that you're going to be deported within a reasonably foreseeable time, Green said. The government is often unable to effectuate a detainee's removal in that time frame if the U.S. doesn't have strong diplomatic relationships with that country, said Philip Rohde, the managing attorney for the Florence Project. Before ICE can deport a detainee, it must coordinate with the individual's country of origin and have certain travel documents, such as a temporary passport. That's largely what was holding up Yu's deportation to China. U.S. judges don't let you stay an unlimited time in detention, Green said. Habeas petitions for those with withholding of removal orders are more complicated. Under Biden-era immigration rules, if migrants passed through another country on their way to the U.S., they had to apply for asylum in that pass-through country. Otherwise, they were not eligible for asylum in the U.S. However, if an immigration judge found that such an asylum seeker has a credible fear or persecution in your home country, Rohde said, the judge can order the migrant to be removed but bar the government from acting on it unless they can prove the conditions in the migrant's home country have significantly changed. That's the situation that Nicaraguan immigrant Jose Suarez Chavez is facing right now. He entered the U.S. in November of 2022 and was denied asylum and ordered to be deported. But in July, according to court documents, an immigration judge granted him a withholding of removal. Less than a month later, ICE deported him to Mexico, where he was kidnapped, raped, and subjected to sex trafficking before he returned to the U.S. out of fear for his life. according to a filing in his federal habeas corpus petition. Since then, he's been detained in ICE's Central Arizona Florence Correctional Complex. Chavez's habeas petition, filed on April 1st, is still pending. His immigration attorney did not immediately respond to inquiries from Phoenix New Times. Prior to the Trump administration, people like Chavez would typically have been paroled into the U.S. until something changed in their cases. But now, they're spending months and months in ICE lockup as the government tries to remove them to a third country, a country that they have no connection to, Rohde said. So far, the results of habeas petitions have been generally effective. In 2025, federal judges ruled in favor of detained immigrants in roughly 97% of decided habeas cases, according to recent federal court tracking data. Petition filings have skyrocketed since then. For example, 10 habeas cases were filed in Arizona District Court on March 4th alone. A judge ruled in favor of the detained person in 60% of those cases, either granting the detainee full release or ordering a bond hearing, which the government must provide within 7 days. Of the other habeas petitions filed that day, 3 remain active and 1 was dismissed. Not a magic bullet. Habeas petitions may be successfully springing more ICE detainees, but they're not a cure-all. Things have slowed down more recently due to the high number of habeas petitions. In March, magistrate judges began to be assigned to habeas cases to meet that demand. Some cases are resolved in weeks, while others take months. How quickly decisions are made in these cases depends on the judge, Rohde said. Some judges feel the need to act very quickly on these petitions and only give the government a few days to respond, Rohde said, while other judges are giving the government as many as 20 days. It's kind of a luck of the draw, he said. Are you going to get a judge that moves things along, or is this going to be a more lengthy process? Even if a federal judge rules in favor of a detainee, that doesn't mean that person is out of the woods or even out of detention. A federal judge may order a bond hearing, but those are heard by immigration judges, who are not part of the judiciary branch but work instead for the Department of Justice. Thus, it's less likely that immigration judges will grant a reasonable bond amount, several immigration attorneys said. After going through the hoops and hurdles of forcing this bond hearing, immigration attorneys are seeing bond set at crazy high prices, or seeing it being denied entirely, Villalpando said. The justification is usually that a detainee is a flight risk, she added. No amount of bond will satisfy that risk. If a detainee isn't able to be released via bond, it's basically back to the drawing board for immigration attorneys and their clients. And if a detainee is released, like you was, that may not be the end of it. A habeas petition doesn't protect a released detainee from being detained again, or deported. If the government tried to make the argument like, okay, we think we can remove her now, they can be detained at any time, Villalpando said. And again, just to, like, sit for a couple of months in detention, and then, if nothing happens, do another habeas to get them out. Turning Point gets its ass handed to it in the SRP elections. This next story was written by Zach Buchanan and posted on April 8th. This might not be the kind of turning point they had in mind. Leadership elections for the Salt River Project are usually sleepy affairs, but this year's races were unusually high profile. That's because Turning Point Action, the political arm of the Charlie Kirk-founded Turning Point USA, decided to flex its financial and organizational might in the battle to control the massive public utility, which serves 2 million customers throughout much of the East Valley. Turning Point spent gobs of money advertising for a pro-industry slate of candidates and even sent an army of employees and volunteers to harvest ballots, a legal practice in SRP elections, in hopes of fending off a progressive slate called the Clean Energy Team. For all that effort, Turning Point's toxic brand may have worked against it. Per unofficial results released by SRP, Turning Point-backed candidates Chris Dobson and Barry Paisley comfortably won the presidency and vice presidency, respectively, of both the SRP district and SRP association. The former provides electricity and sets energy rates, while the latter is a water utility. But the Clean Energy Team flipped two seats on the 14-member district board, shifting control of the body to clean energy-friendly board members. As a result, SRP will be governed by a board of directors that, on balance, is more open to renewable energy investment and more skeptical of fossil fuels and data centers. The Clean Energy Team also gained several seats on the district's 30-member advisory council. In fact, in 13 head-to-head races for district leadership, including races for president and vice president, Clean Energy Team candidates won 11 of the matchups. On social media, Turning Point claimed a huge victory because Dobson and Paisley won their seats, eliding the losses further down the ballot that relinquished control of the governing board. Democrats had told donors this year this was the inevitable year they would win president and vice president of SRP and control the agenda, wrote Turning Point Action COO Tyler Boyer on social media. They failed massively with a huge turnout, more than four times the normal turnout. Ballot chasing works. Boyer did not respond to a request for comment. Other observers were not so celebratory. Complete botch job by Turning Point Action, losing majority of SRP board seats to leftists, tweeted Maricopa County Supervisor Thomas Galvin, a more traditional Republican who also favored the pro-industry slate. The losses for Turning Point, despite the massive investment of money and effort, could be a troubling bellwether for both Republicans and Turning Point itself as it approaches a crucial midterm election in November. Earlier this week, Democrats picked up another seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, despite efforts by Turning Point in that state. And Boyer spoke about the SRP elections as a dry run for its efforts to win the Arizona governorship for GOP Representative Andy Biggs, a MAGA election denier who is looking to unseat Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs. Biggs is a heavy favorite to win the GOP primary over Representative David Schweikert, but if the Turning Point brand is as harmful as the SRP results suggest, a far-right candidate with Biggs associations and policy positions may be in for an uphill battle. Approaching the end of the program for this week, there's time for one more story, this one written by Zach Buchanan and posted on April 9th. There's a text scam related to Phoenix's new speed cameras. If you haven't heard, speed enforcement cameras are back in Phoenix for the first time since 2019. In February, the city set up 17 new cameras operated by Vera Mobility to catch lead-footed drivers, and the cameras began generating citations late last month. If you get hit with a ticket, Phoenix New Times has a handy guide that lays out your options. But for those of you who haven't been around the block, going above the speed limit or not, it's worth pointing out, these tickets come in the mail, not via a text message to your phone. As annoying as the speed cameras may be, they appear to have generated an even more annoying problem: text scams from random numbers. On Wednesday, the Phoenix Police Department warned on social media and in a media advisory that residents are being hit with hoax messages, scam texts, phone calls, and emails, the department said, demanding payment for citations. If you got one, rest assured that it's fake. Don't click any links, and certainly don't send anyone any money. The Phoenix Police Department does not contact individuals about photo safety camera violations by phone, text, or email, department spokesperson John Hansen wrote in a press release. Legitimate citations are issued only by mail from the Phoenix Municipal Court. Sadly, tech scams have become a fact of life these days. In Arizona, residents have had to combat scammers posing as sheriff's deputies and immigration lawyers. They've also weathered bogus texts from the Arizona Department of Transportation about unpaid tolls, a particularly uninformed scheme given that Arizona has no toll roads. Spokespersons for Phoenix Police and the Phoenix Street Transportation Department did not answer questions about how many instances of the speed camera scam have been reported, and whether any residents may have been victimized by it. Phoenix Police say to report the texts as spam, and if you've been a victim, file an online police report or call the non-emergency number at 602-262-6151. If you get an actual ticket in the mail, though, that thing's legit, though you have to be served for it to be enforced. In that case, you can wait to see if a process server tracks you down. In the meantime, ease off the gas pedal, bud. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for other interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook.